Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome again to Faith. My name is Mike. I am one of the pastors here. It's good to have you with us. We are almost at the end of the series that we've been working through this summer called Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? In just a few weeks, we're going to start a brand new series called God's at War. And that's going to be a church-wide series. Which means that we're going to start a conversation here on Sunday mornings and then continue that conversation together in our small groups. And while we're going to work really hard to make sure that what we talk about on Sunday is good, I'm telling you right now, if you're going to get the most out of that series, you need to get signed up for a small group. If you're not in a small group, you will be missing out on part of what we're trying to do with that whole series. Signups are coming to a church near you very soon, so be watching out for that. And if you want to lead a group, like, I can't just go, I've got power and control issues, I have to lead one. We're open to that idea. Put down your connection card, get a hold of Pastor Dennis, and we would be glad to talk with you about what that would look like. But for now, we are in the midst of this series, and what we're doing again in this series is we are looking at the person of Jesus as Luke reveals him to us. And we're doing a series like this. We've been saying this all series long. There are a lot of crazy ideas running around in our world about who Jesus is. And this is not a new thing. This is not a new problem. You go all the way back to the first century. You had a guy named Luke who was looking at all the nutty ideas that were running around about who Jesus was. And he's afraid that his friend Theophilus is going to get derailed by these ideas. And so he puts on different hats, the hat of a biographer, the hat of a historian, the hat of an investigative journalist, and he writes his book so that his friend Luke, or anybody who reads it after him, can know with certainty who Jesus truly is. So each week we're looking at a different aspect of the person of Jesus as Luke reveals him to us. Now, as we get started today, we're going to look at a story that Jesus told. And I need to warn folks, in advance, the story that Jesus tells today, at first blush, it's kind of confusing, and it's somewhat unnerving. In fact, we're going to read this story, and some of us are going to be like, wait a minute, did Jesus really say that? I mean, it's, you know, if you have a Bible, you're going to open it up, I think it's Luke 16, you're going to be like, there it is, it's in red letters, but this doesn't sound like something Jesus would say to me. What in the world is Jesus trying to get after with this thing? Which is one of the things I appreciate about the book of Luke, because Luke includes several teachings on Jesus' part that when you first read them, they're jarring, they're unsettling. But they're teachings that if you dig deeper beneath the surface, just give you great instruction about how life works and how life is best lived. So let's take a minute. We're going to pray for our church, some of the needs here, invite God to be part of this time, and then we'll dive into this teaching. Father, just as we look at this story that Jesus tells, please pour out your Spirit on us. Please give us wisdom. Help us just to see your truth and who Jesus is in light of that. Father, we just want to pray for some of the needs here at our church, for the Menko family, as Teresa's mom passed away this week. God, I pray for your hand of comfort and healing and mercy on them. Father, for Marco and for Evelyn Cicero, as she is in the hospital, as they're trying to get things stabilized with her cardiac status so they can do surgery on her broken hip. Father, we pray that you would have your hand of mercy and healing on her body, that you would meet her and Marco in this, they would sense your presence, that you'd help them as they're afraid, as they're facing these things. Father, we just pray again, help us to be open to you. Help us to be open to Jesus and his truth. In his name we pray. Amen. So the story that we're going to look at that Jesus tells would probably be better termed a parable. We're going to talk a little bit more about specifically what a parable is in a few minutes, but just as we look at this story, and especially if it messes with your brain a little bit, just keep in mind in the back of your head that what Jesus is talking about here would better be termed as a parable, and that'll help us figure out where Jesus is going and what he's doing. But here's how Jesus' story starts. There was a rich man whose manager accused him of wasting his possessions. So they called him and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job, and I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg." So Jesus starts this story about a guy who's basically a money manager. And Jesus doesn't tell us his name, but for the sake of just trying to keep the players straight, we'll call him Bob. All right? Everybody say Bob.
Bob.
Excellent. Now, if you ever make a mistake and you're describing this story to somebody else and you refer to this guy as Bob and people look at you funny, just tell them that deep in the nuances of the Greek language, you know his name is Bob. And if they were as educated as you, they would know that as well, all right? So Bob, his job is to make the most of his boss's money, the rich man's money. He's supposed to, you know, make good investments and get good returns. And the trouble is, Bob's doing a lousy job. Bob knows he's doing a lousy job, and eventually his boss figures out he's doing a lousy job. He does he basically has an audit done of the work here, and he's like, "Bob, you're doing a miserable job. You can't keep working for me any longer. You get your stuff in order. Next week we're going to march you out of here, right?" This would kind of be like you're working, and your boss comes in, and they say, "Hey, we're done. Enough, you know, pack up your stuff, security's here, they're going to show you the front door," and you're like, "Yeah, okay, I know, and you're not going to fight us?" No, I mean, come on, we all know, I've been here, but I haven't really showed up for this job. I really appreciate all the free time I've enjoyed. I've downloaded a lot of great things off of the internet, I've had some amazing rounds of solitaire, but yeah. And this is no surprise to anybody here. I need to go, right? This is where Bob is at. And even though Bob knows, even though it's no surprise to Bob that he's getting canned, it doesn't keep Bob from panicking. He starts thinking, "What am I going to do? Like, it's not like my future boss is going to call my present boss, for a reference. How am I going to get another job? How am I going to pay the bills? How am I going to, pay the house note, keep the kids off the street, make sure there's groceries in the fridge? What am I going to do now? Because I'm too proud to get a cardboard sign and stand on a street corner. I'm too white collar to make it in a factory someplace. What am I going to do?" And so Bob springs into action. Maybe for the first time since he's working this job, Bob gets creative and he takes some initiative. And here's what Bob does. He says, "I know what I shall do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called one of his master's debtors and he asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he said. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. So Bob comes up with this clever idea. It's a wicked idea, but it's a clever idea. He's like, "Hey, I still legally for a week here, I represent the boss. I still can act on his behalf in financial transactions. I'm going to call up people who owe him money, and I'm going to give them huge discounts so that later on, maybe they will help me out." And so he gets on the phone with the first guy. He's like, "Hey, what do you owe us? How much oil? Cut it in half. That's about 2 years' worth of salary for the average worker, the discount he just gave that guy." Gets on the phone again. "Hey, this is Bob. I'm from Rich Guy Industries. We've got this great debt reduction program. We know you owe us a whole ton of money. How much again do you owe us? Cut that by 200 bushels a week. That's about 10 years worth of salary for the average worker." This would be like you're just in a mess financially. You're upside down on your mortgage. You've got a bad car loan. You've got school loans up the wazoo. All your credit cards are maxed out. And somebody representing all of your creditors gives you a call one day. And they say, "Listen, we've got this amazing program. We've identified you as a prime candidate for this program. We want to cut your debt in half. 50 cents on the dollar for everything you owe, no strings attached. You don't have to do anything else but say yes. What do you say? Yes. Yeah, you'd be like, this is amazing. This is the best news I've ever heard. This is a miracle to rival walking on water. Who am I talking to? This is Bob. And it just so happens I am open to job offers, right? This is what Bob is doing. It's an incredibly creative idea. It's brilliant. It's wicked. It's as dishonest as the day is long, but it's just this amazing idea. He's going to use his position with his boss to lower other people's debts so that when he's fired, he can knock on their doors and say, hey, remember me? Remember when you were going to lose your home? Remember when you were going to get foreclosed on? Remember what I did for you? I saved your house. I cut your debt in half. I saved you 10 years worth of salary. I kept you out of prison and your family out of slavery. Remember what I did for you? I'm outdoors now, you know. So can you help me out? What do you say? This is Bob's plan. Clever plan. Unethical as the day is long, but a clever plan. Now, if Jesus' story isn't weird enough, it gets weirder still. Because the rich man finds out about what Bob is doing here, and here's his response. The master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. Rich man finds out what Bob is doing, and his response is, Bob, that's brilliant. Oh, Bob, that's amazing. Bob, if you'd have taken that kind of initiative earlier, you might still have a job here, right? I mean, yes, you have just robbed me blind, Bob, but, that's legit. I got to respect it. Bob, that's brilliant. This man finds out what his manager is doing, and the master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. Now, anybody finding this a little bit goofy besides me? Yeah, you're like, what's going on here? I mean, here Jesus tells this story about this man who is lazy and who essentially is stealing from the company through negligence and non-performance. And when the boss finds out about it, he fires the guy, lets him know he's going to be fired. And so before he can get this guy out the door, this guy steals even more money, gives away all kinds of money to people who owe the company money so as to create a sense of psychological indebtedness towards him so that when he's out on the streets, he can play on their feelings so that he'll be taken care of someday. Totally messed up story. And when the guy gets caught, instead of his boss condemning him, instead of his boss arresting him or putting him into prison or torturing him or executing him, which are things they would have done in that day, his boss's response is, attaboy, Bob, that's brilliant. I'm going to commend you because you've acted so shrewdly. Crazy story on Jesus' part. And then after getting done telling that story, Jesus gives us a little bit of commentary to reinforce it and to make it all the more disturbing. Jesus goes on and he says, the master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in their dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will become welcome in eternal dwellings. Jesus tells a story about Bob, who's lazy and dishonest. Bob seems like a villain, and yet Jesus makes him out to be some kind of hero. At the end of his story, Jesus doesn't even have enough sense to say bad things about Bob. Like, Jesus should know lazy and dishonest are not okay. And instead of telling a story where something goes wrong for Bob, everything seems to go well for Bob. When Jesus gets done, he then makes commentary about people of the world and people of the light and using your money to buy friends. And it's like, who is he talking about and what is he saying here? Well, people of the world, really simply, are people who are not living life in relationship with God. If there's a God out there, they're not sure about that, and they're not following him. They are calling the shots in their lives. And people of the light, very simply, are people who have decided there is a God, they've surrendered their life to him, and they're trying to live life for him. And worldly wealth, this is your stuff, your resources, your cash. Jesus seems to be saying here that he wishes that the people of the light would take their cues from the people of the world when it comes to money. Seems to be saying here that he wishes people would be more like Bob, his people. Godly people would be more like Bob when it comes to money, and that they would use their wealth to buy friends. And you're like, wait a minute, Jesus. Pump the brakes. This doesn't seem to match up with anything you've said so far about money and godliness and integrity and more. What in the world are you doing? And it's at this point that I'd say, okay, let's push the pause button on Jesus and his story. And let's go back to the beginning again. Remember we said at the beginning that Jesus' story is a parable. What is a parable? Now some of you are thinking, oh, a parable, parable, parable. Oh yeah, it's that egg-shaped thing that we learned about in math back in high school, right? No, that's a parabola, all right? A parable, simply put, a parable is a story. It's a story that's meant to make a point and draw out a response. A parable is a story that it's meant to drive home a point. I should hear a parable and walk away from that going, ew, that's the one truth I'm supposed to understand from this story. And a parable is meant to draw out a response. I should walk away from a parable going, ooh, in light of that truth, this is what I'm supposed to do now. And so with that in mind, this idea a parable is going to make a point and draw out a response, let's go back to Jesus' story. And let me suggest to you the truth that I think Jesus is trying to put his finger on and the response he's trying to elicit from us. See, Bob is unique. He's very different from most people. Now, he's not unique in that he's lazy. I mean, just think about it. How many of you know somebody who's lazy? How many of you live with somebody who's lazy? How many of you are sitting next? No, don't do that. All right? Leave that alone, all right? All right? Lazy is not unique in our culture. Neither is being a thief. I mean, you get on the news, you find corporate fraud all over the place. What makes Bob different is Bob knows the future. Not horoscope, tea leaves, you know, crystal ball kind of know the future, but Bob knows what's coming. He is in the unique position that his boss has told him, hey, in about a week, you're done working here. Most of us don't get that. Like, most of us don't know what's going to happen at work on Thursday, and we probably do not know for sure that they're going to escort us out of the building, that we're going to be trying to figure out how I'm going to pay the bills and a mortgage and take care of the kids and all that kind of stuff. Bob is in this unique position where he knows what's coming. And so what Bob does is he does everything he can to plan for that day and to prepare for that day. He knows that a day of reckoning is coming, and he's doing everything he can to live for it. And the master commends Bob. Jesus says, I wish my people were more like Bob. Not because Bob is a dishonest, lazy thief, but because Bob knew a day of reckoning and rewards is coming. And Bob had enough sense to live in light of that truth. Bob did everything he could while he still had a chance to get ready for that day. And so Jesus is saying, man, I wish my people would be more like Bob. I wish my people would live in light of the fact that a day of reckoning and rewards is coming. Because they should know. See, if I'm a child of the light, I should know a day of reckoning and rewards is coming. If I'm just reading my Bible and paying the least little bit of attention, it tells me a day is coming where all the darkness, all the pretense of this life is going to be lost in the brilliance and the glory of the coming of Jesus. And on that day, I am going to stand in his presence with my life laid bare and exposed before him, and I am going to give an account for how I have spent everything he has entrusted to my care, my life, my time, my resources, and more. That day should not be a surprise to me. I know the future. And Jesus is saying, man, I wish my people would live like they knew the future. Man, it is so frustrating to me that while they know the future, they live like they have no idea that day is coming. When it comes to money, I wish my people would live more like Bob. See, the point Jesus is trying to make is that as God's people, we should know what's coming. But so often, we live as though we have no idea what the future holds. Now, if that's the point that Jesus is trying to make, the response he's trying to draw out becomes pretty simple. Jesus would have us live as though we know what's coming. He would have us live as though we are trying to get ready for that day. Jesus would have us, when it comes to our money, he would have us be shrewd. To be shrewd. Now, what do you do in order to live as though that day is coming, to prepare for it? How do you live shrewdly? Jesus alludes to a couple of things right here in the passage. The first thing I think Jesus would have us do is be generous towards others with the money that we have access to. He says, I tell you the truth, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Now, I don't think Jesus is saying here, hey, use money to buy friends. Or when you get to heaven, use money to buy your way in there. I don't think Jesus is like, hey, here's what you do. You're going to get to heaven someday. Peter's going to be at the pearly gates. He's the gatekeeper. Wait for a break in the action. This will be easier to work this transaction out. When there's nobody else out there, you just kind of walk up to the gate and be like, hey, Pete, how you doing, buddy? Listen, I'd like to come in. If you let me in, I'll make it worth your while, if you know what I mean. What do you say, Pete? Come on, let's make a deal here, pal. No, that's not what Jesus is getting after. Jesus is pointing out that money can be used to bless relationships in this life and in the life to come. And that money is a tool that can open doors into eternity. Generosity will bless relationships here. Think about it. I'll bet you've never had this conversation, and I'll bet you probably never will. Like, you're talking to another person, you're like, hey, what's the deal with that guy? Like, he's always alone. Nobody ever hangs out with him. Nobody ever seems to want anything to do with that guy. What is the deal with that? Oh, I can explain that. That guy, you know what his problem is? He's too generous. People just can't stand that. They don't like him giving them stuff. That kind of generosity just repels people. They don't want anything to do. That generosity just makes them sick. If he wasn't so doggone generous, he'd have some friends. You probably never had that conversation, and I bet you never will. Generosity is good for your relationships here, and it opens a door for relationships in the future. Just think about this. What if you approached evangelism through the strategy of generosity? What if when your neighbor's car is down and out, you walk next door and you said, hey, listen, you got one car, we've got two, your car is down, we can make it work for a minute on one car. Why don't you use one of our cars until you get your car straightened up? Or that single mom you work with, what if you just bought her groceries for a month? No strings attached. Hey, feed you and your family. Or that college kid you know who's working multiple jobs and going to school full time, and you see them every other day when you're in the coffee shop getting your frappe, lappuccino, whatever thing, right? Your $10 coffee. What if you bought their books for a semester? I guarantee you live like that with other people, eventually somebody's going to say to you, why are you doing this? And all of a sudden, you have a door that's opened up into eternity. You have an opportunity to say, I'm doing this because the God who I try and follow, He's a generous and gracious God. It's been said about Jesus, his son, that while he was rich, for my sake, he became poor. So that me being poor, just spiritually, I was broken. My life was poverty stricken because of my sin. And Jesus left the glory of heaven and came here to earth. He became poor so that I could be forgiven and free, so that I could be spiritually rich. And now if I'm going to follow him, he's called me to be gracious and generous like he's gracious and generous. Think about that strategy as opposed to going over your neighbor's house and knocking on the door and be like, hey, you're going to hell. You want to do something about that? I'm just saying, if the goal is to get people to heaven, which strategy is going to be more effective? You see, Jesus is saying, use your money in such a way when you get to heaven, there's a chance that somebody's going to walk up to you and say, hey, there's a lot of reasons I'm here. One of them is because of the way you were generous with your money. Thank you. See, getting ready for a day of reckoning, Jesus says, this begins when we're generous towards others. Then the second thing Jesus would have us do is revealed in commentary that he continues to make. Jesus talks about making sure that we're serving God and not money. That God is the master in our lives rather than the money. Jesus says, right after getting done commentating about Bob, he says, no one can serve two masters. Either you're going to hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve both God and money. Just look, you want to get ready for the future. Live as though God is the master, not your money. Now, how do you know if you're living with God as your master or money as your master? There are a host of different ways you can figure that out. Let me just share some really simple ones. If God's the master, then I look at all my stuff and all my resources and all of my money. It's not mine, but it's God's. This is God's house. This is God's car. This is God's stuff. That's God's money in the bank. That's God's retirement portfolio. I'm going to invest that money thinking this is God's money. How would God want me to invest his money? As I spend money, this is God's money. How would God want me to spend his money? And then when it comes to giving, I'm going to recognize, hey, God has said to me, hey, you keep 90 to invest and to save and to spend, and then you give 10% back to me in the form of a tithe to your church. If God's the master, there's 90 for me, and I'm giving 10 back to him. However, if money has become the master, if somewhere along the lines money has managed to worm its way into my heart and work God off the throne there, and I'm serving my money now, then I think about all the stuff, all the resources, all the money. This is mine. It is my money. It's my stuff. It's my house. It's my car. These are my investments. And as I'm spending that money, I take me into account. As I'm investing that money, I do so from my perspective. As I'm saving that money, I'm saving it as my money. And when it comes to giving, I'm not worried about what God has said with this 90-10 thing. No, that's my money. I'm keeping it. Jesus says, hey, if you want to get ready for a day of reckoning that's going to come, that you should know is coming, you're going to live as though God's the master and you're the steward. Not otherwise. So, as we wrap this up, I want to do so by just beginning to think through three simple questions. And we'll start thinking about them today. And I would challenge you just to chew on them throughout the week. So here we go. Question number one. Am I living like I know what's coming or not? Jesus expects that if I'm a child of the light, I should know. A day of reckoning and rewards is coming. With all that has been entrusted to my care, all that was really God's in the first place, and I'm just supposed to use it for his purposes and his glory. This day is coming. Am I doing everything I can to plan for, to prepare for, to live with that day in mind? Or am I the kind of person who Jesus is expressing frustration about in the story he tells about Bob? Do I live like I know what's coming or not? Number two, am I making friends with my money? Am I generous with the money that's been entrusted to my care? Are other people inclined to say to me, why are you doing this? Am I stewarding the resources that have been given to me by God in such a way that it's opening up doors to eternity for other people? Can I expect that when I get to heaven someday, somebody's going to come up to me and say, one of the reasons I'm here is because of you. Thank you so much for the way you were generous with money. And then number three, am I serving God with my money, or am I simply serving my money? Do I look at the resources in my life as mine, or are they God's? When I'm spending and I'm saving and I'm investing, am I doing so with the mindset, this is God's money that I'm doing this with, or is it mine? And when it comes to what God has said about giving, am I keeping 90 and giving 10, or am I keeping it for myself? And here's the thing, if you're not giving, why is that? In my experience, there are a host of reasons. Real quick, we'll just hit three of them. I have found that some people go, you know what? I'm not doing this 90-10 thing because they're not following Jesus. Like, hey, I'm not even sure if there's a God out there. I'm not following him. I'm not doing this thing until I'm decided to follow him. And I get that. If that is the case for you, let me suggest this to you. You can follow biblical principles and experience the benefit of doing so even before you're following Jesus. And I would encourage you to do that for a couple of reasons. One, when you follow biblical principles, it will make you better at life and it will lead to a better life for you, even if you're not following Jesus. And following biblical principles is a great apologetic. It's a great way, I encourage you, put God to the test. See if he can't come through. See if he isn't true to his word. See if doing life his way doesn't come with benefits or not. Because I will contend you'll find that it does. And eventually, you're going to have a weight of evidence pointing you to Jesus as the Lord of your life. It's dangerous business. I got no problem. Test God. See if he's not out there. See if he can't come through. This is one of the ways you can do that. Other people, they'll be like, you know what? I'm not doing this because I can't. They've lived with money as the master long enough that they've dug a hole for themselves. And there's no way now they can meet the financial obligations that they now have and give the way that God's calling them to give. And if that's the case for me, then what I need to do is I need to take a step back and figure out, okay, what are the steps I need to take over time to untie some of these knots in my financial rope so that I can honor God and serve him with my money rather than serving just my money? And then the third most common reason I hear people say about why they're not giving, it's because they're mad. Something went down at their church, they didn't like it. Somebody made a decision that rubbed them the wrong way. And they'll say things like, you know, I'm not giving them my money. I'm mad at them. I'm not giving them my money. I don't trust the leadership there. And if that's the case for you, just let me ask you this. If you're not giving 10% to your church because you're mad at them or you don't trust the leadership, then where is it you're giving 10% instead? Because if it's about you're mad at them or you don't trust them, but you're going to honor God with your money, you're giving it somewhere else instead. And if you're not giving it somewhere else instead, but the reason you're not giving it to your church is because you're mad at them or you don't trust them, can I suggest to you that I'm mad at them or I don't trust the leadership is really just a smokescreen that justifies why you're keeping it all for yourself and that money's become your master? Now, let me offend you just a little bit more. If that's the case for you, get right with your church. If you're mad at somebody, get right with them. And if your church is a place where you can't trust the leadership, why are you here? Get right with your church, get to a place where you can trust your leadership, or maybe you need to find a place where you can actually trust them. So, who is Jesus? According to Luke, he's somebody who wants us to know how life and money works. He's somebody who wants us to do everything we can to get ready for a day we know is coming. And he tells us that we can do that as we're generous towards others and as we make sure that God is the master.